Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Political stunners in the UK and France last week. Huge wins lined up in Parliament for French President Emmanuel Macron's brand new party. A little more than a year old, France's traditional parties, left and far right, trounced. Across the English Channel, British voters rebuked Conservative Prime Minister Theresa May, denying her the big win she had gone for, and calling into question May's mandate to negotiate the Brexit for Britain. This hour on Point, the UK and France turning politics upside down. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is going on with the turmoil in Western democracies lately? What's the message from the UK, from France? Are there lessons for the United States here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from the continent, from Brussels, is Ryan Heath, senior European correspondent at Politico. Ryan Heath, welcome back to On Point. What happened in France this weekend?
Well, that was a bit of a stunner, like you said. At one level, it's a total landslide, but it's also a landslide of unenthusiasm if you look at the turnout numbers. So Macron has been very successful in swiping away his opposition. He really comes across as the new guard. He has finally calibrated his list of candidates to make sure it's new faces, that it's gender balanced, that it really is different from the lists of people that we used to see put forward to the French people. And that's succeeding. But when half of the population doesn't turn out to vote, that raises questions about, is the momentum slowing overall? If we look behind the headline figures, maybe there isn't that depth of long-term support that we are seeing when we have the winning or the successful candidates come before the cameras.
I mean, certainly his supporters were ready to say, this is big. This is French President Edouard Philippe said the results of the election show the French people are behind Macron and France is back.
France is back. For a month now, the president has been a symbol of confidence, drive and audacity, both in France and on the international stage.
And here, one French voter telling NPR he wants to see Macron's new party, Republic on the Move, make significant gains in French politics.
We want to give Macron a big majority to govern, to put in place his program, which is a good mix of free market economics that also provides people with social support.
Ryan Heath, you're watching this up close. I mean, certainly he will have that kind of incredible number of seats, it looks at this point, in the French Parliament, 400-some out of 500-some.
Absolutely. So the real risk for Macron, should he carry through what those numbers are suggesting, is that there will be minority factions forming within his new party, his new movement. And those minority factions will actually be bigger than the standard opposition parties, including the Republican Party of the centre-right, the Socialists on the centre-left, and Marine Le Pen's National Front. And the National Front, let's not forget, had their worst performance on Sunday since 2010. So it really looks like their bubble has burst. So there's a lot for Macron to work with. But of course, when you haven't been able to anchor your movement because it's only been there for 12 months, there's a lot of potential for instability to come out of that success as well.
In the UK, we saw the left, the Labour Party, come on like gangbusters. In France, they performed very poorly. The far right, Le Pen's party, also really stumbling here. But this centrism of Macron is being put forward as the big winner over the weekend. Now, you point out a lot of French didn't vote, but those who did went strongly to the center, while the UK seemed to go somewhere else. We'll ask Lionel Barber of the Financial Times about that in just a moment. But how do you interpret the
Is it a triumph of centrism in France, right?
I think what it is a triumph of hope. The French political elite are very clever, but they come from a very similar mold, most of them. You can't really be eccentric or different in a lot of walks of life in France, and that sort of anyone who tries to do it differently kind of gets crushed very quickly. And so it required a situation where France really became a victim of its own rigidity and getting stuck in a mode where it didn't necessarily believe it could do things differently. Cast your mind back 100 years to France from 100 or 120 years ago. That was a vibrant palace, Paris. That was the innovative force of the world. That's not really what you associate with France today. And so Macron has really succeeded in reminding French people that they can be world leaders, that they can do things differently, and that they don't just have to follow the molds that are handed down to them from their political class. And I think that's why you're seeing a change there.
The very young 39-year-old new leader in France and his brand new party, they will, it looks now, come into the French Parliament with a rather tremendous majority. On the other side of the English Channel, let's take a look there. Last Thursday, a real shock for Theresa May, who called these elections 3 years before they were necessary or required, because she thought she could gain a greater majority and go into Brexit negotiations with a strong hand. Instead, she couldn't even get a majority, had to get into a new coalition to do that. Labour came on strong as the Conservative Party stumbled. Here's Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn on Friday saying that Theresa May should go.
The Prime Minister called the election because she wanted a mandate. Well, the mandate she's got is lost Conservative seats, lost votes, lost support, and lost confidence. I would have thought that's enough to go, actually, and make way for a government that will be truly representative of all of the people of this country.
Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, and here is George Osborne, former Conservative Chancellor, telling the BBC over the weekend he thinks it's only a matter of time before Theresa May loses her position as Britain's Prime Minister.
Theresa May is a dead woman walking. It's just how long she's going to remain on death row. And I think we will know very shortly. In other words, we could easily get to the middle of next week and it all collapses for her.
Dead woman walking, that is not the sound of anything like the victory that she had anticipated. Ryan Heath, stand by there on the continent. I want to go to London as well now. Lionel Barber joins us. He is editor of the Financial Times. Lionel Barber, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. I'd like to say one or two things about Monsieur Macron,
yes, sir,
if that is possible.
Yes, please.
I think Ryan is right in his analysis, but it's important to see Macron. I think the nearest analogy is a bit like de Gaulle back in 58. This is what the Fifth Republic was built for, a figure, if you like, outside the system. Political parties discredited. Mm-hmm. People are really disillusioned with the Socialist Party, and the centre-right has been imploding for some time. And Macron, you can't understate his achievement. I mean, he triumphed. He's had a little bit of luck with the economy improving,
yep,
and a scandal surrounding Fillon. But still, he's now become this huge figure occupying a very broad center and with both other parties discredited. So this is the Fifth Republic was made for him.
Help us explain, and I don't know if you see it this way, but from over here, it can look like the UK set up, went to the polls and went left. And France set up, went to the polls, and went center. Is that accurate to your mind, Lionel? And how do you interpret
it? No,
that?
I don't think it is.
Okay.
I don't think it is accurate. Partly because Mrs. May got more votes than a Tory leader has had for at least 25 years.
Mm.
What happened was both parties, Labour and Conservative, played to their base. And the other parties, UKIP, for example, that did extremely well and essentially swung the Brexit referendum last year,
yeah,
in
UKIP
favor
who
of
drove
leaving,
that
they
move,
imploded.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think it's true to say that the center ground was demolished in Britain. I think both parties played to the base, both leaders. But Mrs. May, who thought she could triumph over a 1970s-style socialist, who with time, by the way, looked a lot more friendly and media friendly and reasonable mm-hmm. as time went on. Mm-hmm. She just didn't convince. She led a presidential campaign. It was supposedly about her and about strength and stability. And the longer she was under the limelight, she looked less presidential. And in the end, as you say, managed to squander a 20-point-plus lead, and now she's leading a minority government.
What does it mean that UKIP, that drove the popular support ultimately for the Brexit, for the UK to leave the European Union, did so incredibly poorly? Is this the British public having second thoughts about the Brexit vote? And does the Brexit still happen in anything like was anticipated?
Well, I think there are two main reasons. One is that the party was built around one person. This often happens with populist parties, and in this case, it was Nigel Farage.
Donald Trump's buddy.
And he's not the head anymore. He wasn't in the campaign. But the most important reason is that UKIP had a cause, and that was United Kingdom independence, get out of Europe. Well, we are on our way out of Europe. Brexit happened, so they are party without a cause, and I think people realize that.
Ryan Heath, looking from Europe, I mean, you've covered France, but you're right there in Brussels. What is now expected by Europe from this UK? Theresa May, instead of being empowered to be a strong negotiator for the Brexit, is now, well, you heard George Osborne there saying, a dead woman walking. How's Europe interpreting what just happened in the UK? Ryan.
I think there's very little faith that Theresa May will last beyond the medium term. What is certainly wanted is a quick start to negotiations. I think people in Brussels are really sick of waiting, and they don't want to be wrapped around the domestic political fingers of Theresa May. But what's expected? Well, they don't really have expectations anymore. It's assumed that the negotiations won't kick off on Monday, June 19, which was the initial expectation. There may be a surprise in store when Theresa May comes along to the next EU leaders' summit next week. And, of course, people would assume that some negotiations begin by the end of the summer. But I think that this has been dragged on for so long now that people have stopped making assumptions and stop making predictions, and now they're just waiting. They're ready to go, but they are waiting, and the ball is firmly in the UK's court.
Lionel Barber, step way back for a moment here. It has looked like such a tumultuous time, in the US and the UK and on the European continent. We had a rise of right-wing populism. Vladimir Putin saying, this ain't working for the West. Are Western democracies finding their feet here, Lionel, or something else?
I'd give a qualified optimism here about Europe. I think the populist surge it hasn't disappeared, but it's certainly in retreat. And Macron's victory is a huge moment for Europe. And maybe we can explore that, because I think the French-German alliance is coming back. France is back. And we are coming out of Europe at the very time Europe is getting its act together.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the stunning political waves of the last week in Britain and France, the big losses of the hard-right populists and the left in France, and where this goes. Lionel Barber is with us from London, editor of the Financial Times. Ryan Heath is here, senior European Union correspondent for Politico Europe, joins us today from Brussels. You can join us as well. What is happening with politics across the pond? Are you watching the upsets, the reorientations, if you will, in the UK and France? Do you envy France ditching the old dug-in parties almost, starting fresh with Emmanuel Macron and his new party? Do you understand what's going on in the UK? Do you think the Brexit will still really happen? Here yesterday was the president of Emmanuel Macron's Republic Onward party. This is Catherine Barbaro, celebrating the unprecedented success of the young political movement there in France.
The meaning is clear. They want the action undertaken by Emmanuel Macron ever since he was elected President of the Republic to be continued. And today, they have expressed the desire to see in the French National Assembly a majority that is a consistent majority.
A kind of fresh start, France is back message there out of Paris. In London, a little tougher, Theresa May was hanging in. Here she was on the doorstep of her official Downing Street residence on Friday, saying that her new government would lead the Brexit talks.
This government will guide the country through the crucial Brexit talks that begin in just 10 days and deliver on the will of the British people by taking the United Kingdom out of the European Union.
Well, maybe they'll start in 10 days. Maybe they're not. Maybe they won't. Ryan Heath is telling us from Brussels now. And plenty of pushback on that as well. The next day, demonstrators outside Downing Street in London protesting Theresa May, chanting the name of the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Lionel Barber in London, what are the odds that Brexit just doesn't happen or doesn't happen as imagined?
Those are two very difficult questions.
Yes.
I would be very careful indeed about forecasting that Brexit won't happen.
Okay.
But you can't look at the vote last week as saying this was an anti-Brexit vote. The terms of Brexit may be, however, turn out to be different from the way that Mrs. May suggested they should be, which was a very hard Brexit, or she would call it a clean break, where Britain came out of both the single market and the customs union. There may be something which is less abrupt, where we're talking about transition arrangements, where, if you like, the business considerations are going to take greater prominence than what Mrs. May cared about, which was reducing immigration. And also she was concerned about the jurisdiction of the European Court. So I think that so much is fluid, by the way.
Yes.
I hesitate to make any predictions as somebody who did not, and I can say this, you know, frankly, I did not think the country would vote for Brexit. My wife did. She just never told me. But, you know, the Donald Trump winning, yes, I kind of thought that would definitely be possible. But we've been so surprised. Who realistically 12 months ago would have said Britain out of the EU, Donald Trump in the White House, and Emmanuel Macron in the Elysee? Not many.
Ryan Heath there in Brussels. Is Europe prepared to consider some kind of deeper, longer-term economic relationship with the UK in a Brexit if the UK rejects the free immigration that has been central to the EU's character?
Well, we have to separate out a couple of issues there. For the EU, it's very clear. They have four interrelated principles, including the freedom of movement across borders. So if you want to be in either the EU or the EU's single market, their internal market, then you have to accept the free movement of people. And that will be the difficulty for Theresa May. While the country has not really embraced Jeremy Corbyn outright or embraced any alternative to Theresa May, it was effectively saying, let's put some kind of break or let's not give a blank check to Theresa May in these Brexit negotiations. So she is stuck, committed to her red line of controlling the borders and pursuing a global Britain. But if she wants to pursue those things, she can't get what she wants or what the EU might like to have as an arrangement with her, which is to have the UK still in the EU single market. So it's going to be very difficult for her to maneuver around that.
Can she somehow stand down on the end to free movement of people, Lionel Barber, to I don't know.
I don't think she can, but I do think that in some form or another, it may be worth exploring the idea of an emergency break in the event of a surge in migration. That doesn't address Mrs. May's position, but certainly people were anxious about. And when Britain was booming compared to the rest of the continent, a lot of people did come into the country and the government got that all wrong in the numbers that they forecast would come in. So it's early days, but I think we should be looking at it will require the support of the other 27 countries, and they will be very resistant to in any way impinging on the free movement of people. And the Central European countries will be very concerned about any suggestion about emergency breaks, because a lot of their nationals have come over in search of sometimes low-paid jobs. So, you know, let's just see. At the moment, the position is hard Brexit. We're not compromising on freedom of movement.
Lionel, we've just got you for another couple of minutes. Let me ask you, if we pull back very large here, we're here on NPR in the U.S. this morning, NPR correspondents in Moscow talking with folks close to Vladimir Putin, saying the big question in the world today is order versus chaos, with the suggestion that Putin represents order and Western democracy lately has suggested chaos.
Well, that's interesting, given the protests in Moscow when Alexander Navalny was
big challenge
arrested,
Putin,
presumably in the name of order.
What about Western democracy, though? Do you see these recent outcomes in the UK and France as demonstrating a kind of righting of the ship, or I don't even know if that's the right construct for this. But there's been a lot of, you know, China's been giving a lot of side eye to democracy as the US and Europe have wrestled with change in recent months and years. Putin eager to portray that as a kind of flailing. What do these outcomes in the UK and France tell you about how Western democracy is doing, Lionel?
We need to be really careful about writing an epitaph for Western democracy.
Mm.
Well, first of all, the lesson in America, and you don't have them, is referenda, at least national referenda. You do have statewide propositions, etc.
Yeah.
But the point here is that the chaos in the UK was triggered by this referendum called by David Cameron on Brexit.
To directly
he thought
a popular vote.
Mm-hmm, sorry? Mm-hmm.
A popular vote as opposed to the representative government model.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, they've been conflated very stupidly in this country. But the fact is, we have a representative government, we have a representative democracy. And on this instance, we handed it over to the people. It was a narrow vote, but it was a vote against, up and down, but in a very divided country. And this is what has unleashed the instability in a country which is actually, relatively speaking, certainly in my lifetime as a journalist since the 70s, had a high degree of stability. There's a second issue, which is the disillusion and the crumbling of traditional parties and the notion of the left-right divide. And that certainly affected the UK, where other issues like immigration, ethnic diversity, etc., these other issues have played a much bigger role. And you can see the way in which populist parties have certainly thrived recently on the European continent. I would perhaps argue they've peaked, they haven't disappeared. But that's another phenomenon which is a threat to the established order, to the established parties. But the third point, and again, this is, I don't know whether Ryan agrees with me, but I would very hesitantly say, look, Europe has been in crisis for the last nearly 10 years since the global financial crisis.
Yes.
You've had a sovereign debt crisis. You've had very high unemployment, surging populist parties. But actually, in the last 12 months, many people thought that Donald Trump's election and Brexit would be a virus that would spread throughout the continent. Actually, it looks more like an antidote. Europe seems to be, the silent majority is speaking up in Europe, and the extremists have been seen off. So we may be seeing, I'm not saying a great new integrationist wave, but certainly a higher degree of cohesion and cooperation than we've seen for some time. And maybe Donald Trump has actually helped that.
A kind of a allergic response, perhaps, out of votes in the UK and France and maybe beyond. Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, with us from London. I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us today.
No, it's a pleasure to be on point.
Ryan Heath with Politico in Brussels, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Kathleen in Buffalo, New York. Kathleen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I actually think your panelists may have just answered my question, because I was wondering if anyone saw a connection between Donald Trump's victory and the decline in the populist parties in the UK and France. And I think he just touched on it.
Well, he touched on it. Let's explore it. Yeah, I'm glad you stick with it, though, Kathleen. I think there's more to explore there, and let's do that. Ryan Heath, standby in Brussels from the UK now. Gabby Hinsliff joins us from Oxford, columnist with The Guardian. Gabby, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And from Washington, David Rennie is here. He's Washington Bureau Chief, Lexington columnist at The Economist magazine. David Rennie, thanks for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
Gabby, you've been right there in the midst of everything that transpired last week in the UK. How would you answer our caller Kathleen in Buffalo, New York, wondering about the effect of Trump on the outcome of the UK elections, one way or another?
I don't know if there's been a direct impact from Trump, but I think certainly you can feel the ripples sort of coming across the pond towards us. I mean, I think what the two things have in common is that what we've had here is a big a vote or a revolt against the established option. And that you were asking earlier whether, you know, Britain's kind of lurched to the left and France has lurched to the centre. I don't think it's about left and right. I think they have both lurched against what has been the sort of accepted conventional political norm. They went for change. You know, the Corbyn argument was the system's broken, people aren't getting a fair deal, you know, let's throw it all up in the air, the system's been rigged against you. And that's what people responded to, the idea that it was something very different ideologically about what he was offering, but also that he's a different figure than a sort of conventional politician, you know, slightly more shambolic almost. He's not sort of the polished item that we've come to expect. And that, I think, the sense in which that didn't count against him, or his inexperience didn't count against him, that was very reminiscent to me of what happened in the US elections. And that you saw almost Theresa May was playing Hillary Clinton almost to Corbyn's Trump, you know, saying, I am the competent, experienced, not very exciting candidate, but, you know, I'm a safe pair of hands, and he's very volatile, and you don't know what he would do. And actually, a lot of people thought, well, I don't care. You know, I'll vote for change.
We're looking at the very interesting election outcomes in the UK and France just in the last handful of days. In the UK, the Labour Party making real inroads there. Theresa May nowhere near what she thought the outcome would be, back on her heels. Friday morning, Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, spoke after he held his own seat with an overwhelming majority, said politics in Britain have changed.
People have said they've had quite enough of austerity politics. They've had quite enough of cuts in public expenditure, underfunding our health service, underfunding our schools and our education service, and not giving our young people the chance they deserve in our society.
David Rennie, you're watching all of this from Washington for The Economist out of London. How do you interpret the interplay of American politics, Trump presidency, and the UK, and if you want to go so far, the French vote?
So I think your caller from Buffalo, if the question was, did people look at Donald Trump and think we want nothing to do with that, so we're going to choose something consciously that is kind of the un-Trump, I don't think it was quite that. Both these elections in France and the UK were strikingly domestic, if you like. And actually, you quite rightly, you were talking earlier with your other guests about Brexit. One of the things that I think worries us at The Economist is there really is a very hard discussion that needs to be had about what's a realistic Brexit deal. This election really never rose to that level. It was very much a kind of very domestically focused campaign. And it's very hard to see the British people telling the government this is the kind of Brexit we would like. You can say they did say what they didn't want. It's true that the hardest of Brexit versions probably doesn't have a mandate, but it wasn't a kind of great national discussion about how to navigate this very dangerous moment in British history. It was strikingly navel-gazing, seen from a distance. There's an interesting analogy as well, I think, with Bernie Sanders. So we discussed the parallels with Trump. Jeremy Corbyn, I think his appeal to young voters reminds me a lot of what I heard from young voters covering the 2016 election, covering that sort of Democratic primary when you listen to Bernie Sanders. I think there's a difference between the two men, which is that Jeremy Corbyn has had the great good fortune to turn sort of silvery-haired and look like everyone's favourite grandfather in that Bernie Sanders sort of way. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn's a really nasty piece of work. He's a very hard-line, hard-left guy, with a kind of whole clique of very, very hard left people around him who want to basically take over the Labour Party and impose a vision that is not supported by anything like a kind of plurality of British voters. So he's a much less benign figure, I think, than
Bernie
Sanders.
Are you so sure that those young voters don't want what he's offering? They voted for him. Not just because he had silvery hair.
So if you listen to what he was saying, and his manifesto was much more moderate than the things that he has stood for over the years. But, you know, essentially he was offering, when he says we've had enough of the of austerity politics, what he was really offering was gigantic tax rises. So to help American readers understand, listeners understand it, if you earned above $100,000, the equivalent of $100,000 a year, the basic rate of national tax was going to 45% income tax. It was going to go to 50% if you earned over $150,000. And then there were sort of punitive extra 5% levies for the very highest paid. So these are, you know, pretty high tax rates. And he was offering stuff familiar to Bernie Sanders fans about free college tuition and things like that. But there was, I think, unfortunately, a sense that Jeremy Corbyn offered people everything that they wanted and didn't really explain in any great detail how it was going to be paid for, even on Brexit. The truth is, there's been some reporting. The New York Times had a piece the other day quoting British voters who love Jeremy Corbyn, were very upset about Brexit. The piece, bafflingly to me, did not mention the fact that Jeremy Corbyn supports Brexit, a slightly softer version, but really he does support Brexit, and worse, I think, has not really explained that there are tough trade-offs on those things like immigration controls and access to the single market. So I'm not sure there's a really realistic program that Jeremy Corbyn is offering.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about the stunning political waves of the last week in Britain and France, the big losses of the hard-right populists and the left in France, and where all of this goes. You can join us this hour. What is up with Western democracies these days? Turmoil or turnaround here? What's it mean that Donald Trump maybe won't or can't visit London now? He's too worried about the protests there. Is there a lesson for the U.S. in the swings of the U.K. and France that we've seen in the last week? Strong youth vote turnout in the U.K. had a lot to do with the success of Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn there. Demonstrators outside Downing Street in London over the weekend protesting the re-election, or Prime Minister Theresa May still being at Downing Street in the Conservative Party. Many of them are young, like these two women who spoke to the UK's Metro newspaper.
Labour has come out today and been incredibly strong. The youth has spoken.
The youth has been empowered and spoken.
We've gone from 43% voting in the last election to 72% in this election, which is absolutely incredible.
A huge surge in the youth vote there. The European Union watching all this. On Friday, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, saying it's hard to tell where the UK stands now on Brexit.
Our British friends have gone to the polls. 1 year after the referendum, we still don't know the British position in the negotiations on Brexit, and it seems difficult to predict when we will, because democracy often requires time.
Ryan Heath is with us from Politico Europe in Brussels. Gabby Hinslip with The Guardian joins us from Oxford, England today. And David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist, is here. Steve in Madison, Wisconsin. Steve, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm honored to add my voice to the conversation.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
Well, in my mind, the events in France and England and here in the UK are directly related to one thing, Trump. It's a backlash. And as you noted earlier, that young people came out strongly for the new party in England. And it's a backlash. People see the denial of rights, the neo-fascism, the oligarchy types of things brewing in America, and Europe being more inclusive, more entrenched diversity already. In my mind, people are reacting to that and strongly.
Steve, we'll test it with our guests. Need to note, not a new party in the UK. That's, of course, France, and Macron has his new party. Labour been around the UK for a long time. But let us hold that thought there. An assertion from Steve in Wisconsin that we've got an anti-Trump dynamic going here. Scott in New Haven, Connecticut. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I wanted to touch base, go back a little bit to one of your previous callers who is wondering if the and this may relate to UK as well, who is wondering if the vote for Macron was rebuffing the Trump vote here in America, like the backlash to Trump. And your guest speaker said that she actually saw a relationship to it in that Macron was a rebuff to the political status quo in France. I was wondering if perhaps it is actually a rebuff to both the status quo and Donald Trump, since Le Pen represented a ideology more in line with Trump, that the massive support for Macron was actually both a rebuff of the status quo and a rebuff of the ideals presented by Trump.
Scott, let me take it to our crew here. Gabby Hinsliff, jump in. Maybe start with the UK and take us further into how you see the Trump effect, if there was one.
France is a separate thing. I mean, I think the Trump effect here, I know it would be very tempting to see it as a response to Trump, but I think if I had to be brutally honest, being repelled by Trump is not something that's unique to Labour voters in the UK. There are many, many, many Conservative voters who were appalled by the rise of Donald Trump, and I don't think that, but voted Conservative anyway. It just didn't really come up as an issue in this election. The one time that sort of Trump really impinged on people's consciousness was after, obviously, the attack in London, the most recent terrorist attack in London, when there was a great anger, to be honest, with the way that Donald Trump responded by criticising London's mayor at
yes.
a time when, obviously, our city was under attack. And people were appalled by that. But that wasn't a sort of a political party thing. That was just an almost universal feeling that that was beyond the pale. I think it's interesting, the one sense that Trump did come into the election was the Conservatives used him as an example. They said, you know, look, you maybe think that you are safe not voting for us because Jeremy Corbyn can never win, but look, the unexpected happens, you know, and one of the things they cited as an example of the unexpected happening was Trump winning the election in the US, and they almost using him as a warning sense in that sign, you know, we're in a different times when all sorts of crazy things can happen, so don't think that Labour could never win. I honestly haven't heard any voter citing Trump as a reason for voting for Jeremy Corbyn. I think Macron, as your other caller pointed out, I think in France maybe something different going on. Macron is a reaction against a lot of things, not just against the sort of established government, but certainly in the UK. There was that sense that Le Pen was tainted with the same sort of things Trump. But that wasn't really an issue for us in this election.
Ryan Heath, pick it up there from Brussels, looking at France. Do you see a Trump effect having played out there or not?
Yeah, I would actually make a point that is probably relevant to both UK and France. And I think that there has been a trend amongst two groups in recent elections, up until the last 12 months or so, where both people who felt left behind by social and economic changes and people who, you know, their lives are going quite good, I think they both felt that there wasn't really a value in voting and engaging politically. For the people who were left behind, it was a sense of, well, they're all the same and none of them care about us. And people realized by voting for Brexit or giving their once-in-a-lifetime vote and coming out for Donald Trump that things didn't necessarily have to stay the same, that there was a way to inject themselves in a conversation. And then I think in a bit of backlash to that, those people who sort of were not particularly political, who felt that their vote didn't make a difference and just wanted to get on with their lives, when they see things like Brexit or Trump happening, they're motivated to understand that if they're not engaged, then they can end up with very severe consequences that they don't like. So I think it's kind of two ends of the same pendulum, basically, and people realizing that politics is not so much a luxury or a sideshow, but actually more of a necessity than they were giving it credit for up until the last 12 months.
Let's get a call from Stephen in Maine, Vinyl Haven, Maine. Stephen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'd like to just point out that we need to also, Germany, we need to look at Germany and what's happening there, the largest economy in Europe right now, and the upcoming elections in August of this year,
yes.
where Merkel is up for re-election.
Yes.
I think that she's one of the people who had reached out very early to Macron to form an alliance with him, and I think this is something that, with her re-election, would really cement the foundation for a reawakening, if you will, of Europe. And how do your people, your experts, think about this, and what are they expecting here?
Well, I'll take that. Thank you, Stephen. I'll take that first to Ryan. You're watching from Brussels, and yes, of course, Germany has its own election coming up. I mean, your headline, one of your headlines in Politico was Lost Continent, i.e. Europe, rediscovers its mojo. How do you see the upcoming German elections and what people are anticipating there playing into the unfolding story, Ryan?
Mm-hmm. I think you're seeing in Germany probably what Theresa May wanted to have happen for herself in the UK, and that is a strong and stable government with a society that essentially has a stable outlook and not a rigid debate, but a well-framed debate. Even when you have 1.5 million refugees flooding in the space of 12 months, while it causes disruption, it doesn't cause, you know, fundamental chaos in German society, because it's a very well-ordered society. So I think that Angela Merkel is going to do very well in those elections, and it's because she thinks in very strategic terms. She doesn't allow herself to operate only tactically. Like, she knows where she wants to go to in the long term, and she lines things up in a very step-by-step way. It's A, then B, then C. She doesn't go A to F to B to Z. That's mm-hmm. not the way Angela Merkel conducts her politics. And I think that is a quite German trait, and that's serving Germany well. It's not that they get their way only because they are the most populous country or the biggest economy, or they somehow pay more for bailouts and other EU projects. It's actually because Germans are also very organized. So they don't deviate from the plan, and then they often watch people fall by the wayside as they get worked up and excited or out of steam because they weren't willing to follow the plan.
David Rennie, there you are with The Economist in Washington. The Politico subhead here is the EU's enjoying a revival just as Britain sinks into instability. The big headline, Lost Continent Rediscovers Its Mojo. How do you see that, David?
Look, I think there's something to that. I think it's pretty, it's clearly embarrassing to be British at the moment in terms of our politics. Having been based in Brussels for 5 years, I would always be wary of betting big on Europe really coming together and sorting itself out. There's a lot of, basically European politicians know that what a lot of their voters want is just to have continued kind of prosperity, but they're kind of tired and old and exhausted, and they don't have tremendous ambitions to shape the world. Sitting here in Washington, I tell you what is really fascinating is I don't think that European voters are watching Donald Trump and voting according to their view of Donald Trump. I think clearly that's the case. But the team around Donald Trump, particularly the more nationalists around Donald Trump, people like Stephen Bannon or Stephen Miller, his close advisors from that sort of ethno-nationalist worldview, they had a theory of the case that they were sharing with foreign governments when the first foreign leaders and foreign ministers came to visit them, even before the inauguration, which was that Brexit followed by Trump was this domino theory that they cheered on, that people like Angela Merkel were going to be the next to be swept away, that Marine Le Pen was probably going to win or could win in France.
The populist right sweeping in.
And it was proof of their theory that the peoples of the West were in a rage about, say, Muslim immigration, about the impossibility of trying to assimilate refugees from places like Syria. You still hear this when I'm on radio programs here in the US with US conservative pundits. They say, of course, Germany is in total chaos and you've had these waves of rapes and refugees are kind of causing fury and this is going
huge
to kind of disrupt politics.
Mm-hmm.
Completely inaccurate description of mm-hmm. what is happening. So I think that's really important, that Trumpian theory of the case doesn't seem to be holding up.
Let's go to Matt in Paoli, Indiana. Matt, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, my name is Matt Heimbach. I'm the chairman of the Traditionalist Worker Party, which is a white nationalist political party. And what I've been hearing in the conversation, you know, I've had the honor of being able to go to Europe, to Greece, to Germany, the Czech Republic, and other countries to meet with other nationalists. And I just hear continually this dismissive tone when it comes to both American politics and European politics, that demographic replacement of our populations is happening. Within 100 years, there won't be any majority European countries. When it comes to the working class, globalization, which is cheered on by the left, it's cheered on by the conservatives, is displacing us from our jobs, adding more labor to the market, is driving down wages. And there's just this very dismissive tone that when we vote or we march or we act in our own best interests, we're always called names, we're always insulted, and it's basically the white working class. Our vision of the world doesn't really matter. It seems like both the left and the conservatives actively work against us. And I think that's why you see the rise of nationalist movements in Europe.
Matt, listen, I don't want to insult you, but it's not my point at all here. But we are a very diverse country with the equal rights embedded directly in our Constitution. So what is the point of being a white nationalist? Why not embrace the country that we have and the beauty of this our ideology, which is equal rights for all, Matt?
Well, the idea that I should accept demographic displacement on the continent that my ancestors colonized and built for me, and especially if you look in Europe.
For you? I mean, what do you mean for you? You know, they championed a set of ideals which were about all men are created equal.
Well, the first immigration law ever passed by our founders actually limited immigration to white persons of good moral character. I mean, this idea of the founders being multicultural, that's absolute lunacy up until the 1960s.
You reject the American notion, the fundamental American notion of all men are created equal?
Equality is a social construct. The idea that human beings just innately, that evolution exists with every other single animal, but that human beings across a wide variety of spaces evolved exactly the same at the exact same time.
Matt, you know what? I don't want to, it's not a matter of insulting, but I'm a citizen and so are you, of a very diverse nation with a distinctive ideology at its heart that says all are created equal. And I'm sticking with that. Gabby Hinsliff, you know, there's been a lot of tension in the UK about immigration. When you hear that nationalist, white nationalist calling from the American heartland there, does that resonate with British nationalists, or does that sound uniquely American somehow to you?
A year ago, there's certainly American aspects to that debate that we thankfully haven't had here. But I think a year ago, that would have been very, very, very familiar here. You know, you were hearing a lot of that argument during the Brexit referendum. Immigration was the number one issue in politics. People were tremendously concerned about it, that idea that that somehow the white working class was being ridden a roughshod, that they were becoming minorities in their own communities. That was very, very, very active in the run-up to the Brexit referendum, and it was one reason that Leave won. And it's odd that during this general election campaign, hardly anyone's mentioned immigration. It's just not been an issue. And one feels that is probably because people think that was settled by the Brexit referendum, and that therefore it's no longer a live issue. They've said what they said their piece on that and don't need to say it anymore. So it has completely almost receded from the political debate here. But, of course, it could very quickly come back. I think what we were discussing earlier, whether freedom of movement remains, is possibly back in play during the Brexit talks now, whether it might be a softer Brexit with less emphasis on curbing immigration. I think what people often forget is that if all the parties say, fine, that's right, you know, we're doing away with freedom of movement, the EU citizens won't be able to come here anymore just whenever they want to, you have to replace it with something. We have to have some immigration system, and it can either be a very relaxed one that still allows large numbers of people to come here, or it can be a very tight one, which may have really serious implications for the economy. So I think we have another argument about immigration to come, we're sort of in a lull in that argument at the moment.
Gabby, our time is short. Donald Trump apparently communicating to the UK he doesn't want to come visit until there won't be big protests. Will there ever be such a time when he can be guaranteed
that? He might have a very long wait, then, I'm afraid.
Ah, fascinating.
I can't see a point where Donald Trump will be welcomed with open arms at the moment.
But there was supposed to be a golden carriage, as I recall.
I don't think we're rolling out the red carpet. Ordinary Americans were always delighted to see in the UK, however.
Gabby Hinsliff, columnist with The Guardian, with us from Oxford, England. Thank you very much for being with us today, Gabby.
Thank you.
David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist in Washington. David, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ryan Heath, Senior European Union Correspondent for Politico Europe, joining us today from Brussels in Belgium. Ryan, thanks very much for your time and insights.
It was a pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for all your calls and comments online. Good to be with you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.